Hello and welcome back to First Year Jitters, the only show where we love easing your first year shivers more than the fact that, get this, there are 100 arrows in the quivers of a Tarkatan warrior. I mean, like, that's crazy. A Tarkatan warrior, like, that's insane. I am your host, Omar Kavej, by the way.
Recording in progress.
Now, this guest right here, this guest is actually very special, as he is about to make history on this show. He received his Bachelor in Anthropology from the University of Toronto in 1989 and his PhD in Hebrew Bible and Archaeology from Harvard in 1999 and is an instructor in the Department of Archaeology and Heritage Studies and the Department of History at Laurier. That's right. For the first time ever, we have a professor on the show, so it is my honor to welcome Dr. David Lipovich on the show. How are you doing today, Dr. Lipovich?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Omar.
All right. Well, thank you again very much for coming on, and let's just get started. So the first question we want to know is, now you went to school in UFT first, I believe. Yeah. So what was the first day, if you can recall, the first day at UFT, what was that like for you becoming a first-year university student? Kind of tell us about that experience.
It was an interesting experience. I had been a pretty sheltered teen with relatively low self-esteem. And I just the process of actually kind of getting myself up in the morning, getting myself down from where I lived up in the suburbs down to campus, and walking into a room full of utter strangers. I knew no one in my program. Was pretty traumatic. And I'd already sort of kind of come in a weird situation that in I had intended all my high school career to be an engineer. And I'd been accepted at Carleton, but I couldn't find a place to live. Back in the 1980s, like, most universities simply had virtually no residential space, and there was nothing on the market in Ottawa. Ottawa wasn't the city it is today. And so I had come back to U of T. I'd already turned them down, and I begged them to let me back into the arts and sciences program with the idea that I would stall for a year, get some better grades, and reapply. And so I'm already, like, I'd spent weeks waiting and waiting and waiting for the university to finally accept me again. So I didn't even know where I was going. So I was kind of pretty stressed out to start with. So my first day was stressful. And that it really felt like I was on my own. And it kind of was the beginning of a very, very stressful first year. First year in general was not a good thing.
I see. Well, thank you very much for that insight. That's really cool. Now, also, as you know, you are a, you know, professor in the Department of Laurier. So just as a little extra thing here, what was your first day at Laurier like? Like, you first discovered Wilfrid Laurier University?
Again, I think a little less dramatic. I mean, it was traumatic in its own way. I had to, in Laurier's great wisdom, they decided that the ideal time for a class was 8:30 in the morning for somebody who was commuting in from Toronto. And so I did the commute here, which is about 2 hours at that point. So I was here at some insanely early hour, just in case. Got here and discovered for the first time just how inefficient Laurier's computer systems are. Got here to discover my desktop in the classroom wasn't working properly. And of course, everything is, you know, set up to go on PowerPoint, and I don't have a laptop with me. So it was, again, there was a little bit of stress there, but thankfully, you know, whatever it was at that point, something like 30 years or so after my first day at university, I kind of got over those self-esteem issues. And so I was confident and comfortable. I knew worst case scenario, if I had to, I could wing it without my computer, but it was a lot easier once the things got started. And the one thing, again, I found Laurier to be a pretty welcoming place. I really found, you know, students were remarkably polite and friendly. It seemed fairly low stress. But it's, again, like anything new, there's always a degree to which, you know, something that's new is, you know, can be mildly terrifying. You just, again, as you go through life, you kind of learn that it's like sometimes you just have to go, you know, well, the fear isn't going away. It's going to be there. I need to learn to work with it. And so you just learn to sort of, you know, sort of bury that fear and just plow through what you need to get done and, you know, hope that you do a good job at it.
I see. And just curious, when did you first come to Laurier? Like what year?
Let's see. I think my first year here was 2015.
2015. And like back then, like again, like the reliance, you know, on computers is very apparent. And now look at us. We're 9 years later. And now with all the technology coming out and all the innovations, it's technology is progressing. I think I'm going to sound very old by saying this at a rate that I think these future generations, we're still able to keep up. Like, I feel like you blink and there's like a new technological innovation that happens, you know? It's just crazy.
You know, I think that's one of the things, you know, as an archaeology and history prof, I kind of talk about is that, you know, when we look back and we look at how technology has changed over time, you know, from we go all the way back 4 million years ago to the first hominids that made tools. It takes about 1 million years for them to improve that tool to the next sort of technological level. The next time that it changes, instead of 1 million years, it takes about 100,000 years to improve the technology. Then it takes about 10,000 years to improve the technology. Then about 1,000, then about 100, then about 10. We're at the point now where major technological change happens about once a year. And in some cases, it can be more than once a year. The thing is, when you're talking about something taking 100 years before you see like a dramatic leap in technology, society has time to adapt to it. When you're talking about change that happens on a monthly basis, we don't have time to adapt. And so we make stupid decisions. And one of the things about humans is like, if we're given a new toy, a new technology, there's, you know, like, you know, you can use it for good or you can use it for evil. We tend to use it for evil. I mean, the one that sort of, I think is probably the, you know, kind of good example, and it's one that everybody should be, you know, be familiar with, is the internet and the World Wide Web. When I was, you know, starting out as a first year undergrad, there was no internet. There was something called ARPANET, which was the precursor of the internet. And it was a system that was designed so that if there was a nuclear attack on the United States by the Soviet Union, the universities would still be able to communicate with each other and the government would still be able to communicate with them, their offices and with the universities for military research. And so it was entirely about the military and about research work. There was nothing that was frivolous about it at all. And then there was this slow process as it sort of developed. And by the time I was in grad school, there was we were in the first stages of what becomes the sort of internet. And so you've got this mostly publicly accessible system, but you've got interfaces that aren't graphic, right? So you could put in questions and search for things, but you could send emails, but you really couldn't get imagery. You certainly couldn't get moving imagery. And so again, it was like the only people who used it were typically researchers. And so again, it was still being used primarily by people using it for like legitimate kind of research purposes. And then the World Wide Web happens. And all of a sudden you have a system that is readily accessible to everybody, right? It's you can you know, go on back then AOL or whatever, you know, for next to nothing and, you know, listen to your phone squeal at you and then connect up to something and everybody could access, you know, could access it. And what happens when that becomes the reality? The entire World Wide Web is dominated by porn, right? Instead of it becoming a place where people could share information, where we could make connections between people all around the world, we used it to sell pornography. And that's sort of the nature of big tech. that when it happens too quickly, instead of looking at it and adapting it and using it for things that are practical and useful and beneficial to humanity, we tend to turn it into whatever makes the greediest people the most money the quickest. And it's the same thing that's happening now with things like the sort of explosion of what they're calling AI. So things like ChatGPT, where, I mean, this is a tool that's out there that can do all sorts of really kind of interesting things. And instead of it being used for beneficial stuff, the overwhelming majority of people seem to be using it to find ways to cheat, or they're using it to do things like create, deep fakes so that they can market products that they're selling by saying that, well, this person endorsed it and all they're doing is using AI to create a moving image of a person without their permission. I mean, that seems to be, for the most part, the most visible things we see coming out of stuff like ChatGPT. There's lots of productive things that could be done, but we don't jump on that. We jump on the ones that make people money and get people power. And so I think part of the problem we have is we're kind of moving too fast technologically for society to adapt properly. And so we're going to make a lot of mistakes. And it's, again, the trick is as a professor, we have to deal with this on a constant day-to-day basis. I mean, whether we have a use for ChatGPT or not as individuals is irrelevant. We have to know about it because students abuse it. Right. We, at the same time, we can't just, you know, like, dismiss it out of hand. It's not going away. We need to find ways that it can be of use to us or of use to our students in a way that's beneficial. So we're the people who have to adapt. But in the meantime, society tends to take too long to adapt to things constructively.
Okay. Well, thank you. That was some incredible insight. Thank you very much, Dr. Lipovich. Always good to get some insight. Next question we kind of move on here is, in U of T, what kind of residence did you live in, and how did you adjust from being from high school to university?
Well, I lived at home. So, and the reality was, to be honest, at that point, the entire residence space for U of T was like a couple of hundred people in a school with, at the time, there were 28,000 undergrads at U of T. That they could house probably fewer than 1,000. So the norm was people, if you went to university, you tended to either, if you were a Canadian living near, you know, in Ontario, you probably were coming from somewhere close to U of T. It was, again, it was a sort of different model. The assumption was you went to school close to home. My first experiences with living in dorms was when I went to grad school. And I actually lived for 6 years in the dorms at Harvard. I was a resident advisor for 4 years so I could get free rent. And it was an interesting experience. And I really, like, looking back at it now, like, I think graduate residence was a great experience for me. I met all sorts of people from very, very different, diverse backgrounds. I got to meet different kinds of scholars and different sort of ethnic groups and stuff. It was a really positive kind of experience. But for me, it was one of the things that made being an undergraduate a lot more, tolerable, was living at home. I had a very distinct life separate from university when I got home. I came home from classes, I ate my dinner, I did my work. And then on the weekends, I hung out with my high school friends. And so my life didn't make this huge social change that can really be, you know, pretty traumatic for people, particularly, as I say, I was kind of a shy person still in my 20s. It would have been really hard for me to make friends. I did eventually, you know, make friends over time at university, some of whom I'm still in touch with. But it's, again, it's my high school friends, the people who I hung around with away from school. I created that that sort of boundary. I gave myself something that was a part of my life that had nothing to do with university. So I had an outlet, an escape. And that's, again, it's like, it's one of the things that you were talking, and I were talking just before this, is like, one of the things that got me through my first year was having other interests outside of you know, what I was doing for work. And so for me, it was coming home at the end of the day after getting whatever readings and stuff I needed to get done, was sitting on my computer and playing games, killing things to vent, that I needed that catharsis to get over the stress of the day, or I would have gone postal. It's really important to have whatever works for you as an individual, something that helps you manage the stress. You need something that's not about relaxing, at least in my opinion. It's about venting. It's about something that gets rid of all the pent up frustration and stress and sometimes anger, and vents it in some way that is constructive. You know, for me, I'm not an athlete, so I went to computer games, but it could be going to the gym or doing martial arts, or I don't know, something that gets rid of it in either a physical or a mental way that gives you an outlet, so that the stress doesn't just percolate. Because it's again, I mean, it's very my underground experience was 40 years ago. It's very different from yours, but the one common thing is that it's always been stressful, right? You have to find ways to deal with that stress. And the sort of, I think, biggest difference between being an undergraduate 40 years ago and being an undergraduate today is the assumption was by the administration at the university was that you were going to be stressed, and that was normal, and that it was part of the experience of being an undergraduate was learning to cope with the stress, not having a system that was designed to reduce your stress and not teach you ways to deal with it by constantly trying to find ways to work around it. Because the reality is, in the real world, very few people are going to let you work around your stress. They're going to expect you to work through your stress. And it's as important a part of learning as an undergraduate to deal with that as it is to learn the material you're being taught in a lecture. Part of the experience is learning to figure out how to manage time and deal with people and manage stress.
Wow, well, again, just incredible insight. Thank you very much, Dr. Lipovich. Now let's talk about, I think, a subject of your expertise, academia. I have some academia questions here. First up is time management. I know for first years, at least here in this school, time management can be a bit of a struggle. So what was time management like for you? And do you have any tips for first years, particularly as a professor, on how to manage their time for like assignments and evaluations?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that time management is probably the biggest problem for most undergrads. I was very lucky in a weird way. I went to a private school when I was in my younger days, that where we were taught four different languages. And so I had, I'd come home at the end of my day and have 3 or 4 hours worth of homework as a 10-year-old. And so I had to learn how to budget time as a kid. And that held me in good stead all through high school, where I went to a public high school, and then through university. And I think it comes down to sort of three things. So the first thing, and this is what I've always done, I literally still do this today. I have my calendar, I sit and I plot out every day everything I'm going to do during my work hours, basically to the minute, so I know everything will get done. So I kind of would come home, you know, at the end of my you know, lectures or my school day when I was younger, and you know, I would have my meal and then go, okay, let's say, you know, I'm going to work from 7 o'clock till 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And so I would split the day, like I would kind of gauge how much work I thought I had to do, how many different subjects I was dealing with. And I would either sit, like I would sit down with a piece of paper and I would plan out the day by splitting it into, I don't know, 15-minute, 30-minute blocks, depending on how much I had to do, and make sure that I allotted an appropriate number of blocks for each thing. So if I had 4 things to do and I only had 2 hours, I got a half an hour of work. It was allotted to each one. And so again, sometimes that wasn't enough time, but it meant at least I could try and get through everything. So I kind of strategically and what's the word I'm looking for? I organized my time. So that's one thing is recognizing that if you just start working and just work until you're done, you're going to get one thing done and you're never going to get at the others. You need to sort of sit down and plan it out. And I also found for me, and I know this isn't the same with everybody, but I think most people to at least some degree are like, you have to understand that pulling all-nighters is possibly one of the stupidest things you can do. You need sleep. You guys, if you're coming at this, you know, coming into university at 17 or 18 years old, your body has not fully matured. You need sleep. And so it's, again, don't plan on working crazy hours. It's like you need to be able to go, I work until, in my case, it was typically 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And then I would go, I now need at least an hour to unwind. I'd watch TV. I'd play a computer game. If I was in grad school, I might go out and talk to my friends in the hall when I was living in the dorms. But I allotted time to unwind. And then I would go to sleep. And if I still had work that needed to be done, like there was a midterm or something I needed to study for, and it was an absolute necessity that I get more time, and I'd run out in the evening, I got up extra early and I started my day earlier and I got through things that way. So it's the first thing is about budgeting your time, actually sitting down and planning it out. And that, like I say, includes budgeting time to eat, to sleep, to relax. The second thing, and I this is something I figured this out very quickly as an undergrad, because I was in a science program. I was, taking an overload course load of six classes. I had more work than I could do. And so I figured right away I had to figure out what to prioritize. If I have six things to do and I only have time to do five of them, I have to figure out which ones are the ones that are worth the most to me. What's going to give me the most sort of bang for my buck? And I find one of the things I find when I deal with students at Laurier is I think a lot of you don't really understand the sort of basic math behind how grading schemes work. And so people will decide, oh, you know, this is only worth, you know, 1%. It's no big deal if I blow off a class. It's only worth 1%. But if you do that every single class, you've just wasted a big chunk of your grade. And it's the sort of thing, it's like, you know, that hour of just sitting there is, even if you don't pay attention, it's downtime from your other work. It's going to help you relax a little bit. Your presence there, you're going to get something, and it's going to make a difference. So it's that, you got to kind of look at it and go, is this really, if I cut this out, is this really the right thing to cut out? Right. So if you have a limited amount of time and too much time to like too many things to do in that time, you have to sit and look at what the value is and actually think about if I don't do this, what are the repercussions? And if I do this, is there something more than what is obvious there that I'm going to get out of it? Is it something that's going to somehow in the long term do me more good to do than something else? So that's the second thing is learning to prioritize what's important and what isn't. And then the third thing, which is the sort of like the bigger planning, right? So this is the, you know, if you're planning out what you do on a day-to-day basis, but it's also, I think one of the key things to do is again, is make your calendar your friend. I mean, you all have smartphones. Every smartphone has a calendar program on it. You all have Outlook, right? You've all got it as part of what you get at Laurier. It's got a calendar. Sit down and put Dawn on your calendar every time something is due. Don't plan if something is due on, you know, the Monday. Don't plan on doing it on Sunday. Plan on having it done for Saturday. That way, if you run out of time on your schedule, you still have a day to deal with it. You have time to proofread your work. I mean, one of the things that drives me crazy as an instructor, and if for those of you actually taken my classes, you will hear me say it every time I talk about a written assignment. The most important thing to do is proofread your work. I get so many things that are submitted to me where it's clear that the student didn't actually read what they wrote because they're like, oh my God, it's like 1 minute before the clock says I'm overdue and I'm going to hit submit. And they submit something that's drivel. They would have been better off to hand it in a day late and take the day's late penalty and just clean it up, because the 10% that they might lose as a penalty is less than the 20-something percent they're going to lose for writing something that's not good. So it's, again, I think it's if you think something is going to take you 3 days to do, don't budget 3 days, budget 4, right? Always overestimate how long you think something will take to do. If you end up with spare time, that's great. You'll slip something else into that time. Your schedule should be adjustable, right? But if you think something is going to take an hour, budget 2. If you think it's going to take a day, budget 2 days. Don't underestimate how long things will take. It's better to have to get everything done and go, oh wow, I thought that was going to take me all weekend, and here it is, like it's only Saturday evening and I'm already done. I got a whole day. I can either work ahead, or I could take some time and relax and do something to blow off some steam. If all you do is leave things till the last minute and under budget how much time it takes, you are guaranteed to be stressed out all the time.
Well, again, that's probably the millionth time I said it, but again, great insight, Dr. Lipovich. I felt that, like, personally a lot, especially when I was first coming into first year, because I came from a high school background. I had to kind of learn the hard way on how to prioritize my time, because I realized that, oh, like, they give you a week to do it. Like, this is me telling you, like, this is where I kind of say, do as I say, not as I do. Don't be the person who, like you said earlier, realizes he has a week to work on something and then leave it till the day before. Like, get started on it. And the thing is, from my experience, if you do just, like, a little bit every day, like, you'll be surprised how good quickly the process goes. Because it feels like every day you're working towards something. It may be minute, but at least it's something. So, again, great insight on that. All right, now I'm moving into a bit more of a humorous question. And it's about humor. So, in U of T, or lore, you're in a university where you were a first year, your first experience, or just university in general, actually. Any funny memories? Like, anything that was humorous looking back and, like, that was a silly time, that was a very funny, humorous moment?
Yeah, I mean, again, I would say my first year, I was too stressed out by what I was doing to find much that was funny. I mean, we kind of joked amongst ourselves to kind of, alleviate the tension. I remember, a bunch of us talking about how we were going to contact the U.S. Navy and, you know, rent the USS New Jersey, the last of their big battleships, and have it shell our math professor's house, because we were all kind of on the brink of losing it. But it was, you know, it's like gallows humor. It was what was getting us through the stress. I think the example, only one I can sort of think of, it's funny, but it wasn't, I'm not sure it was entirely meant to be funny. And I know I do this all the time when I'm teaching. I took a class in, my fourth year, actually, I guess it was my fifth year, at U of T, from a guy who was like me. He was a contract instructor, and we were doing a class on the prehistory of Europe, and so it was a fourth year undergraduate seminar. So we're supposed to do readings and then have these conversations in class, and we're talking about the beginnings of agriculture, and we eventually around 10,000, 9,000, 10,000 years ago, we start to see the domestication of plants and animals, predominantly in the ancient Near East. And this makes a huge change for humanity. We go from being hunter-gatherers to being predominantly farmers. We go from being predominantly nomadic to being sedentary and living in villages. And so it makes a massive difference. And so he turns to us and he goes, so what do you think is the most important contribution of domestic animals, the domestication of these wild species? What's the most important contribution that they make to human society in antiquity? And we're all like putting up our hands. You know, it's like one person goes, well, meat. It's like, no, it's not meat. Well, dairy products. No, it's not that. Well, leather. No, it's not that. Traction. No. And finally, he just looks at us and he goes, it's shit, guys. It's shit. The most important contribution of domesticated animals to human society is the dung they leave behind that we use as fertilizer so we can grow more food, that we dry out and use as fuel in places where there isn't ample wood, so it's heating our homes. They're using it to cook their food. Without it, civilization would not have progressed to the next level because you needed that manure in order to, you know, be able to produce enough food. And he could have said it that way, but it was the idea that I'm standing there in this, or sitting there in this fourth year class, and my professor is standing there screaming at us going, it's shit, guys, shit, stuck in my head. I will never forget that lesson. And I kind of do that every once in a while. I'm sure, yeah, Omar, you heard me do it at least a couple of times yesterday in class. You know, I will, you know, occasionally drop an F-bomb or say something really crudely or flippantly, because I know it will stick in people's heads, that makes it kind of stick. And the same thing, I'll crack jokes through my lectures, not because I'm trying to entertain people, but because, again, I know you may not remember what I said about everything else, but you'll probably remember what was funny. And so I think humor is an important part of teaching. It's, again, I think it's probably an important part of learning too. It's just, as I say, my undergrad experience at least was probably, again, very different from what most students at Laurier experience, because I separated school from my social life.
Interesting.
I came home at the end of the day and I had nothing to do with school except homework. And on the weekends, I spent my time with my friends that I've been friends with for years. And so I never kind of had this sort of common ground where, like, I'm doing stuff that's fun at university. University was never, at least as an undergrad, it was never fun. U of T was about work. It was a full-time job, and I never really looked at it as anything else. Now, it's not that I didn't have enjoyable moments. I liked what I did. But it wasn't fun. It was work. And I think that that's it's a fundamental difference in approach that has changed largely over the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, that this was typical the way of American universities. American undergraduate universities, or, you know, they call them colleges, where it was a place you went to get an experience. It wasn't about the education. It was where you went to meet people. It was where you were going to make connections that would serve you better in life. And so students picked their universities, not based on where the best prof was or the best program or the best co-op. They chose their universities based on who had the best football team, who had the reputation for the best parties. And that was typical of the U.S. It was not typical at all of Canada. We picked universities based on where the place was we were most likely going to get the best education, that was most likely going to get us the best job. And that changed. And Canadian universities, at least Ontario universities, seem to be much more now that the process of choosing is much more like what it was in American schools when I was your age. And so I think there is this idea that, like, the social aspect of university, the partying, the getting to meet new people, the getting away from home and being on your own for the first time, that's the big experience. And it is, it's part of it, but it's different from my experience. I really didn't think about university as being anything fun. And it's not like I didn't have a social life. You know, I went to parties at other universities. I just didn't go to mine. Because to me, it was like, that was like, I don't know. It's like hanging out with your buddies at work. It's like, I don't want to do that. I want to have a life that's my private social life should be separate from my work life. It's healthy, but that's not how university in Ontario works anymore. You know, people think that that's it's as much about the social aspect as it is about anything else. And as I say, maybe there's something positive in that. Maybe it is an important part of the experience of growing up. But I think it often can become, at the very least, a distraction. And sometimes it can become everything, right? I mean, just look at, you know, it's again, like, what are we, like 15 days, 14 days away from the chaos that is St. Patrick's Day in Waterloo. I mean, I know I've met students at Laurier who told me that they chose Laurier because of what happens on Ezra Street. That makes no sense to me, not when you're paying, you know, $6,000 or $7,000 a year in tuition. But at the same time, it's like, I don't look back on my undergraduate years as a fond, fun experience. I look at it as a step in moving along in my education. I had much more fun as a graduate student, but
that's fair.
So again, graduate student is like unbelievably stressful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that insight. Now you see, you're an interesting case, Dr. Lipovich, as since you are the first professor on the show, that means I get to ask a question about being a professor. So you are a professor of the history department and the archaeology and heritage studies departments. I want to learn about your teaching philosophy. What is your goal in teaching students? What are kind of some of the tricks of the trade that you have when it comes to teaching students that you hope to instill in the students that you teach?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's, again, the reality is that humanities programs like archaeology, like history and ancient studies, these are not places you go to get a job, right? You don't go into a history program because you want to be, you want to come out after 4 years and become a professional historian. It doesn't work like that. And so there's really, like, when you come out, there's two paths you can follow. You can continue on into academia and become eventually something, some sort of professional historian, or it's a stepping stone to either some other kind of professional education, like med school or law school or B school or whatever, or it's a stepping stone to going off and getting a job. And the reality is, for humanities, that the proportions are not even vaguely equal, right? It's something like 90 something percent of the people who are going to come through my classes are never going to ever use them in any sort of professional capacity. So if all I'm focusing in on is making sure that you know facts about history, I'm doing you a disjustice. And so I really believe that a big part of the role of an undergrad professor is to not just prepare you for grad school, it's to prepare you for everything else. And I think that that's where again, I try to stress it in all my classes, is picking up all of those sort of secondary skills and habits that are going to serve you down the road. So I tend to try and stress things like learning how to write properly, learning how to think critically, learning how to budget time, learning how to meet deadlines. You know, a lot of the things that I do as a professor may sound like I'm just being nitpicky, you know, docking people grades for, you know, making grammar mistakes. Well, I'm sorry, but I've worked in industry. I haven't always been an academic. I've hired people over the years. And if somebody hands me a resume that's full of spelling mistakes, that resume goes right into the garbage can. It shows me that you don't care enough to actually pay attention. And so it's, again, like, these things that we just sort of ignore and take for granted actually do matter in the real world. You know, the fact that I penalize a student for handing in late work isn't because I'm being a dick. It's because in the real world, if you're in business and you fail to meet a deadline, your company loses money, right? People's lives are at stake potentially, either like in the genuine sense of that, like you're being late for something could cost somebody their actual life, or it could cost them their living. You could do something that costs somebody so much money they go bankrupt or they lose their jobs. And so it's important to learn to meet deadlines. It's important to learn how to communicate. You know, this is why, like, I've more and more started to include in my classes group work, because in the real world, you're going to work with other people. You need to be able to know how to do that. You need to know how to stand out in a group so that people pay attention to you. You need to learn self-confidence, These are things that are part of the structure of my classes. They're not about the material I teach. But at the same time, it's also, again, one of the things as somebody who teaches ancient history and archaeology is, and I kind of equate those two. I'm somebody who comes out of a background where I think of archaeology as a sort of subset of history, is to look at the things that have happened in the past and look at things that are repeating themselves, right? We should be able to recognize patterns. And that's both a useful thing, as I say, in the real world. Recognizing patterns is something that's useful in any field. But it's also with looking at history, it's looking at things that have happened in the past, looking at how societies dealt with those crises, and recognizing what they did that worked and what they did that did not work. And then take that and try and look at that as something we can apply in the modern world. And so there's a value to studying history and archaeology for history and archaeology's sake. And so I try to expose students to as much breadth as possible. So again, Omar, you're in my current class, you know, looking at you know, basically the ancient history of just about everywhere. So that people at least have a taste of what's going on. They understand a little bit about a lot of things. And I think that's, you know, it's always been my sort of approach as an academic, is I am a jack of all trades, as they say. You know, I do all sorts of things. I've worked in a whole bunch of different cultures. I've taught on all sorts of different subjects. I'm a specialist in something extremely arcane and minute, you know, sort of a focused on minutia, but I know how to work that into a much bigger picture because I have this really, really broad education. And so, again, I try to expose my students to as much as possible. And the other thing, which is, again, I struggle with this a lot. It's probably my biggest challenge as an instructor, is I have always thought that the way to deal with students, because it's how I want to be dealt with, it's how I was dealt with growing up as a student, is that if you set the bar high, the students who actually care will work harder and they will learn more and they will excel. If you set the bar low, people reach the bar and stop. You'll still get that handful of people who would excel anyway, but you're not giving them any incentive to try harder. And you're certainly not giving the people who aren't trying any incentive to try harder. And so I also tend to set what often turns out to be kind of ridiculously high expectations for my classes. And I realize that I jam so much material into what I'm doing because I really think that you should know all this stuff. And that if you have all this material, you can do so much more. And so I think I'm doing something that's good for you. And what I've come to the conclusion is that often that's too much. And there it's really hard to find that happy medium. We tend as a sort of institution to either do one thing or the opposite or the other, right? We either aim our classes at teaching to the student who is the A plus student, or we're teaching to the student who's a D minus. And unfortunately, what I find more and more as time goes by, and I've particularly found this sort of in the post-COVID era, is we aim at the D minus student. And it's got to be frustrating for the student who actually wants to work. And it's frustrating as an instructor having to constantly sort of make sure that the student who isn't working still has a chance. So that's my biggest struggle, is trying to find that balance of getting a manageable amount of material with reasonable expectations, but ones that give students an incentive to actually work. Right. So again, that's sort of what I struggle with teaching, but it's again, I'd say my sort of main thing is trying to teach, get you to learn all of those secondary skills, reading critically, writing well, communicating well, working well with others, having self-confidence, learning to speak your opinions, learning to not necessarily trust every opinion you hear, but at the same time to not glom onto useless conspiracy garbage just because it happens to, you know, get the most hits on a Google search. So it's, again, it's about teaching you those things that will be useful regardless of what you do, but will also provide you with tools you might use if you were to go on in the academic world.
Wow. I mean, just wow. That was a lot of really good insight, actually. I think it was very cool to hear that sort of stuff. And again, there's no bias whatsoever. It just happens to be the fact that you are my professor for this term. So
your grade depends on it.
Yeah, but honestly, really, thank you for the insight. It's really cool to get like the insight on a professor. Now, I like asking this question. So you're about history. So why don't we go back in time? Let's pretend we have a TARDIS from Doctor Who, if you're a fan of that show. I'm not sure. Back in time, or the Wayback Machine from God, I'm sure my boy, Mr. Peabody, will take you to the Wayback Machine. That's a very old reference. I am so sorry.
Okay, it's from my time period. They both are.
What would you say to your first year self in UFT? Like, knowing what you know now, like, what advice would you give him? What would you say to him? What would you do?
Well, I mean, it's weird in my case because my first year was in many ways a dead end. I spent a year studying sciences and then switched to archaeology. So, I mean, part of me would be like, don't waste your time doing this. It's not going to go anywhere. But the truth is that I wouldn't be who I was if I hadn't taken that first year. I think looking back, I think the one thing that like I couldn't change, so many things I couldn't change. They were just the nature of things. But I think the one thing that I kind of regret, it sort of goes to something I was saying a few minutes ago, is that I did create this separation between my university life and my private life. And I think I missed out on a lot of opportunities to meet people that might have been, you know, important to me in some way down the road. And I just really did not try to be social while I was there. I really was so overly focused on my work that I didn't really, you know, really kind of take advantage. I mean the sort of personal version of it was like I there was somebody I knew as my first year who clearly was interested in me, and I couldn't see it because I was so bogged down in my work. I was oblivious, and I found out at the end of my first year when, you know, we happened to both take an exam together, and at the end of the day it kind of became clear, but she decided to pack her bags and switch universities and move to Montreal. And so it was kind of missed a what could have been a, you know, major opportunity in my life to meet somebody and have a relationship with them. And it was because I was so self-absorbed in my work, I didn't think about it. And so I guess it's kind of maybe partially what I would say is like, relax a little bit more and, you know, try and actually find a better sort of work fun balance at the university. But otherwise, most of what I did, all the things that went wrong, and believe me, there were a lot, they were all learning experiences. I failed my first year, basically. I failed math outright and had to switch fields, but that's what made me who I am. So if I did things differently, they wouldn't have worked out this way. And despite the fact that this is not exactly how I saw my life at 59, things haven't gone exactly the way they were supposed to, not even close. I'm happy with my life. And if I had done things differently, the things I'm happy with wouldn't have happened. So I guess really, like I say, I think the one thing I would say going back and looking back is like, relax a little.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. As we're kind of closing off the show here, because it does kind of look like we're getting a bit to our limit. Any final thoughts you want to say to the first years listening to this show? Some of those, remember, may be in your classes, so do keep that in mind. Any advice? Just final advice.
I'd say the one thing I sort of just alluded to, and I was talking to you about a little bit before this class, is like the reality of life is that you aren't always going to succeed at things. You are going to fail things. You are going to do badly at things. You need to accept that that's part of life, not sweat it, and look at it and go, okay, I screwed up. Instead of dwelling on that, look at whatever you did that didn't work out the way you wanted and go, how do I make this better? What can I learn from this? Look at failure as opportunity. Always succeeding is not necessarily a good thing. You don't learn anywhere near as much from success as you do from failure. You will learn so much more about yourself by figuring out what it is you do poorly at, because that will help you figure out what you really excel at. If you identify your weaknesses in life, you will be much more capable of identifying and taking advantage of your strength.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. Again, a big thank you to Dr. Lubavitch for appearing on the show and making history as a history professor, as the first professor on First Year Jitters. And guys, just some advice. Just everything that he said is true. Learn from failure. Don't dwell on it. And remember that everything we do in life is a learning experience. And I think that's very important. And guys, if you're going to be outside, please bundle up. Like, the weather today, I didn't even know was naturally possible. I mean, a funny story just before we end off. I was longboarding to a class, because I longboard to classes, and I almost went into a door, because the wind was pushing me so much that even while braking, I almost hit the door. So, please, guys, be safe, and as always, until next time.